Hello, everyone. Welcome to Everyday Sublime. This is your host, Josh Summers, and it is great to have you here listening today. Thanks for your attention. I just want to say that in this episode, I'll be sharing further reflections I'm offering in my Monday meditation sessions around working with beads, meaning working with a mala bead set or a rosary or a garland by any other name, and how within bead practice of meditation, you might explore composing, literally drafting and articulating very personalized mantras to connect you to a personalized sense of the divine. And that's what I mean by beads of bhakti. Bhakti means devotion. So how do our bead practices, or how do any practice we do, whether it's an embodied movement practice, how do our practices support a devotional quality to us, to our highest ideals? And those are often, those ideals are often themselves embodied within the imagery of a god or a goddess. And I think this creative, imaginative type of practice can be very, very powerful and transformative. There's been some very fertile discussion in the Sangha around this, and I want to thank the members of the Sangha, the Riverbird Sangha, for their support to make this podcast freely available and free of advertisements. And if you are interested in participating in a like-minded community of yin yoga practitioners, qigong enthusiasts, yang yoga enthusiasts, and meditators, looking how to bring together all of these practices into an integral life practice that is customizable to your own unique needs, that's what Terry and I try to offer everybody. We try to show ways that everyone can find and discover the best way to practice for themselves. And we do that in conversation in our online community. So if you'd like that support, if you'd like to practice with us, if you'd like our classes, if you'd like to avail yourself of our library of classes, workshops, and tutorials, please do check out the link in the show notes. And we give you 2 weeks for free, plus a free copy of my ebook. So there's no risk. You can sort of see if we're a good fit for you. And I just want to say welcome to all. We have had quite a few new people join recently. I just want to warmly welcome you all in. We do send you an email of personal welcome, but we look forward to seeing you in class. And now, without further ado, here's today's episode, Beads of Bhakti. But as one member just reminded me, today is Earth Day, and for many reasons, I feel that this is a, I hope my talk speaks to, in some way, how our practice can help us tune to the condition of the Earth, both in terms of its motherly properties. It's the mother of our life. And as many of us know, our mother is not healthy. If the earth is our mother, our earth is not healthy, our mother is not healthy. And that's part of the condition that we can tune to. And so the big question that I can't offer a specific answer to, but when we open to our reality like this, and we really feel into the desecration of the planet and the foreboding of what's coming, what we see happening now and the foreboding of what is coming, I feel tremendous overwhelm, fear, and deep existential concern. And in the face of that, it's easy to feel helpless. What can I do? I don't have specific answers that are going to be a panacea for anything, but I do want to put our practice in that context and the development of what we've been exploring in practice. And specifically, as if you've been present, you know that the last several sessions, I've been offering some thoughts around bead-based practice, garlands, malas, rosaries. And I've been trying to share slices of what I'm learning around the ancient history of these practices, the depth of how far back these practices go in our evolutionary record, and specifically how these practices are very likely, it seems, they all emanate from a ancestral worship of the earth, particularly a worship that explicitly petitions and aligns with the divine feminine or the goddess. And this is new territory for me. The phrase I'm borrowing from somebody else is that I've come to see that in so many ways I've been a professional patriarch in my career. And part of what I'm trying to do is atone for that, to recognize that that has been part of my conditioning. And now that I can see it, I can see around it more and start to include broader, different perspectives. So to continue some of the themes, if you read the newsletter yesterday, the phrase that I used was recomposing scripture. That was the two-word theme that captures something that's alive in my own practice. And I want to talk about it a little bit and see if my thoughts can help inspire / energize ways that you explore your practice. And that word recomposition can evoke many things, but it's a word I'm also specifically borrowing from a music teacher. And I want to talk about how this music teacher used the word, and then in sharing how he thought about it, I'm hoping you can see how it could be used in your own spiritual work, your own spiritual practice. So about 10 years ago, it seems crazy to me that it was that long ago now, but it was about 10 years ago. It was when I was in Boston. I happened to come in contact with a professor from the New England Conservatory. His name is Ran Blake, and he was, and is, I believe still, the professor emeritus of improvisational music at the New England Conservatory. And when he learned that I was a out-of-practice saxophonist, he learned that I had a saxophone that I once, at one point in my life, played more regularly and that I hadn't been playing very frequently, he very quickly twisted my arm hard. He pinned me in the corner and said, "You have to come and take some lessons with me. No option here." He's like, basically enforced mandatory lessons. And I had about 3 or 4 lessons with him at the time. And in that time, those 4 lessons, I feel like I got the gist of his pedagogy. I got the gist of his philosophical approach to music, particularly improvisational music and how he approached it. And the way he approached it was, there was no sheet music, or as the Irish would say, there was no dots. There are no dots on the page. There's no sheet music that he let me look at. I couldn't read anything. I couldn't use my my cerebral skills of thinking about music to learn the way he was teaching the process. Instead, what he did was he gave me a playlist. He gave me a short playlist of about 5 songs. And he just said, every day, first thing you do when you wake up, I want you to get as quiet as you meditatively can. Now, you're a meditation teacher, right? You should be good at that. He was ribbing me up from the very beginning about my meditation history. Because if you're a meditation teacher, you should just get calm and center. Just calm and center yourself. And then listen to those 5 songs with your full attention. and do that a few times in the morning. And then he said, throughout as much throughout the day, listen to those songs again. And then before you go to bed, put your headphones on and listen to those songs. So there was the sense of listening to one performance of a song. And as you may or may not know, that there's a canon of compositions. There's a canon of songs in the jazz world known as standards, and that every jazz musician is responsible for knowing that canon, like literally having committed to memory hundreds and hundreds of songs. And so, okay, I was learning five. And after I had spent time listening and immersing myself with the sounds of the songs over and over and over again, then he would say, okay, I want you to sing the first song. I've talked about this before, but this phase of the learning was extremely challenging to me because from a very early age in music, I had been told by teachers that I had, quote unquote, a bad musical ear. That from middle school through high school, I was, the diagnosis was that I had certain musical skills. I could read music well. I had good technique, had decent sound. But when it came to ear training, listening, being able to sing, being able to improvise, I was told my ear was bad. And at the time, I wasn't given much, very much in the way of education, or you could even say therapy, for how to strengthen or improve or grow my oral, A-U-R-A-L, my ear's capacity. So when this teacher had me sit down and try to sing, I can see now I actually had a bit of a traumatic response, a PTSD response. I would flush red, I would sweat profusely and shake a little bit, which I can giggle about, but it was definitely confronting me with a deep wound. But as he persisted and as he applied a gentle pressure of just said, "Oh, relax, get into your meditative centering zone, and from listening, just sing what you remember. Sing what you remember." And his point was that in this process of listening over and over and over again, what the musician in training learns, in his language, is that the musician learns what the spine of the song is. What's the backbone of the song? And that's what assemblages of notes, what assembly of notes are the quintessential pieces that define the melodic contours of the piece of music. And in listening like that, one also intuitively comes to feel both the melody, but also the harmonic landscape of the song, the rhythm and the melodic or harmonic landscape of how the mood and the atmosphere of the song progresses. And he says, once a musician, an artist, knows the spine, it becomes sort of implicitly embedded in their mind, in their heart. Once the musician understands the spine of the piece of music, then they can improvise upon it. They can literally recompose it in an authentically unique and creative way to themselves, which is what every great musician, artist has done. So if you take any of the standards, whether it's Summertime, God Bless This Child, or Autumn Leaves, or Someday My Prince Will Come, there's just an endless list of standards that jazz musicians take up. But if you listen to them, Miles Davis plays it very different from Louis Armstrong, from Chet Baker. Ella Fitzgerald sings very different from Billie Holiday, etc. So that every musician recomposes the spine of the piece of music in a way that is unique and I would add, generatively creative to themselves. Now, I'm using this comparison of music education or improvisational oral jazz education. I'm using this because I think I try to share this pedagogy, the same exact approach, in context with spiritual practice. And I think a lot of times people, I shouldn't generalize too much here, but this is the way it was for me. I approached spiritual practice for many, many years in exactly the same way I was learning jazz incorrectly as a youngster. That is, I was approaching it cerebrally and reading and trying to get the symbols of what I was reading to make sense enough that I could literally just follow them, or as I said yesterday, crib them, like kind of just copy them, regurgitate them, say the right words in the right order, whether it was a recitation of the Four Noble Truths or a listing of the hindrances or whatever it was. You know, I just tried to get the right lists and the right ways of practicing together. And the hope that is, if I could just do it properly, no one would recognize me as a fraud. But in trying to move for several years now into a creatively improvisational based approach to spirituality, and that all stems out of what in yin yoga culture we call the functional approach. What are the intentions? What are the ways of activating or aligning with those intentions? And how does a student, how does a practitioner creatively adjust, explore, develop their own internal sense of when they are aligned with their intentions and when they're not? That's really the, you know, the essence of how we try to teach this approach. So in introducing the beaded practice, I've received some wonderful emails from many of you sharing your own history with it. People who have practiced the rosary at another time in their life and find themselves reconnecting with that practice now, or having worked with Japa Mala at one point and reconnecting with that now. What I want to recommend is that if you think of your journey as one of a spiritual artist, that this is kind of the model I'm trying to encourage, that consider yourself an artist. And I forget who it was exactly, but it might have been a Steve Martin line where he said, good artists borrow and great artists steal. In that spirit, what I want to suggest is that world traditions, whether it be Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, indigenous forms of spirituality, Judaism, Islam, Sufism, just part of Islam, that some of these, and I'm just taking out the ones that come to mind, but the world's wisdom traditions are, in a sense, part of our human ancestry. It's the way I think of it. And they're not this exclusive property or purview of any one culture, that if we're world citizens and we're respectful of these traditions, that these traditions are the bequeathment to us from our ancestors as a species. And within all these traditions, I would say the traditions are like great developments within the art of human spirituality. They're the great rivers of our ancestral human spirituality. And within those, there's going to be language, there's going to be images, there's going to be themes that maybe are expressed uniquely in one that you resonate with. And when that's the case, I would really recommend that you listen and work with that source of inspiration very closely and make it your own, essentially, to practice it, work it, live with it, recite it, contemplate it. And as you do that, I think there's a natural way that as you understand more and more of the spine of what that particular form is expressing, that you will, over time, have insights and intuitions around how to creatively adapt or adjust or self-style the spine and recompose it in your own fashion. And that's what I've been trying to speak to here, is that how do we, it's fine to use mantras that we've received elsewhere, you know, and that could be a starting place. But from that, and maybe in parallel with received mantras, how can we also compose uniquely individualistic, personalized mantras that speak directly to the needs, concerns, challenges, and desires of our own heart? And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who follows my talks pretty regularly, and I follow his podcast regularly, and he's a real spiritual friend from Canada. And he jokingly asked over the weekend, he said, "Have you come out publicly saying that you're praying the rosary yet, Josh? Have you said that publicly yet?" And I said, I did in the discussion session at the end of our practice last week. But I wanted to speak to that part of my journey right now is that I have been very curious and explorative of practicing or praying the rosary in a somewhat traditional form, as described in the book I've been referencing, The Way of the Rose, by two authors. There are a couple, Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. And so what does a Buddhist-based guy like me make of practicing the rosary for a month or so, or a month and a half? And there's a lot I could say on this. A lot I could say about this. The first thing I'll say, though, is that my initial sense of it is that the themes and contemplations of the rosary sound to me very, very similar to the themes and contemplations of tantric Buddhism found in Tibetan practice. Tibetan practices have very elaborate visualizations, the summoning and petitioning of certain deities, deity energy, notably the green Tara worship, green Tara practice. And in that regard, the types of contemplations I have discovered in the rosary feel very similar to forms of practice I've been aware of in other tantric practices. And tantric practices, again, just in general, tend to draw in many themes that are hygienically avoided in other forms of spirituality. So, you know, tantric practices tend to be warts and all practices. The shadow, the light are both embraced and worked with and transformed and So nothing is out of bounds. Sexuality, consumption, your daily life, your job, your relationships, everything is part of a tantric path. It's just more or less how we've been trying to share the practice in general anyway. But specifically, if we're to describe what I think is the spine of the rosary practice, and I want to be clear that my context for the rosary is that it's not a Christian practice at all. It's a pagan practice that existed for thousands of years prior to Christianity. And that pagan earth-based goddess worship that is embodied in the rosary was something smuggled into Christianity and preserved within Christianity, but not itself indigenous to Christianity. And that's where my interest is not so much about how to be a worshiping Christian. My interest is what spine of this deep ancestral practice was preserved in the form of Christianity that gives me access to a way of connecting with the Divine Mother, a way of connecting with the Earth Goddess, a way of aligning my life in appreciation and gratitude for that support. And so when I look at the actual contemplations of the rosary, one thing that's interesting about the practice is that there's 10 beads in a row, and they're separate. Those 10 beads, and they're called a decade. Those 10 beads are separated by some knots in the rope of the string, and there's sort of space in the distance between beads on the garland, and then there's a larger bead suspended between the decades of 10 beads together. And that landscape of how the beads are arranged move through a rhythmic pattern of different kinds of contemplations. But for those 10 beads in a row, which are the majority of the sequencing of this patterning, the majority of this ancient rhythm of prayer, those 10 beads are all devotional beads to the Mother. So and then there's one bead between those 10 beads, and that one bead is a bead of devotion to the Father. So we're working with divine, like feminine and masculine energy in the contemplation. But the emphasis is clearly towards the feminine. It's 10 to 1. It's a ratio of 10 to 1. There's 10 prayers to the earth, 10 prayers to the goddess, 10 prayers to the divine feminine, paired with one to the Father, which could be seen as the prayer to the masculine, prayer to the transcendent, prayer to the light. And then there's another prayer thrown in there on next to those other two that includes a reference of the child, the creative spawn, the creative issuance of the unification of the Mother and Father. This is the way I'm reading it, or I'm interpreting it. And after really starting to feel into what contemplate, like spending time contemplating these mantras and bringing those mantras into my body and really feeling, what does it mean to feel like I am giving thanks and seeking petition from a divine earth presence and a divine earth spirit, a goddess of the earth, paired with the recognition of the transcendent. It just naturally started to occur for me that I could see how this could be recomposed, the same spine of 10 prayers to the earth, one prayer to the transcendent. I could see how this could be recomposed with language that I know and have worked with from Buddhism. So so that the same exact heart of, or the same spine, I should say, could be recomposed with a Buddhist emphasis, where I would say the transcendent element of the prayer, the contemplation, the meditation on the Father is really no different in my mind from the devotion one can cultivate in one's practice for one's own awake awareness, the Buddha within. The Buddha within is the transcendent element of our experience. Namo, and that's in Pali, that is the phrase, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Same deep spine, honoring the transcendent. And then when that came to my mind, that form of the recomposition came to mind, I thought, well, what is the Hail Mary in the rosary? What does Buddhism have for that? Well, in Buddhism, Mary isn't Mary. Mary is Kuan Yin, or the Green Tara. And the mantra par excellence for Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion, is Om Mani Padme Hum. May all beings be free from suffering. It's a universal appeal of compassion. And what's the child when the Buddha aligns with the heart of the mother of compassion, with Kuan Yin? On one level, you could say the Sangha, a community of formation that aligns when these two principles are brought together, that gives forth to the vitality and the energy and the spirit of members of a Sangha who endeavor to creatively embody the principles of awake awareness paired or aligned or unified with compassion. So really the word I wrote down on my page was bhakti. Bhakti. And that's a Sanskrit term that some of you may know. If you've done yoga trainings, you probably come across bhakti, the word bhakti. It may be a new word for you. And what I want to say about it is that in yoga, classical, or I have to be careful with the word classical, because classical yoga is a type of yoga within the yoga tradition. But in the historical breadth of yoga, going back several thousands of years, there you will find, when you look into the history of yoga, that there are numerous paths to the awakened, fully realized potential of a human life. There are many paths. And part of being a good yoga practitioner, it was always imposed on me, part of being a good yoga practitioner was learning to figure out which path you were best suited for and to follow that. So for example, I use the word bhakti. Bhakti means devotion. And it's often said to be, bhakti is described as the fastest of all paths, that it quickens, it accelerates one's spiritual evolution like nothing else. But it usually involves, or definitely explicitly involves, a devotion to a personal deity, some personal devotion to the divine, whether it's Shiva, Vishnu. You know, you had the Shivites in India, you had the Vishnavites in India, you have those that worship Ganesh, Kali. There's so many personal forms of deities that get worshipped throughout India. But it's a personal relationship to the divine. And in contrast to, say, a devotional practice, there's paths of one path is called the jnana path, path of jnana, which is knowledge. And that's a path of not book knowledge, not cerebral knowledge, but contemplative knowledge that involves meditation that looks a lot like what we have done when I've talked about insight meditation, to look very closely at the nature of experience and with bringing bare attention and really investigating the nature of your experience directly. That's really a jnana knowledge path in traditional yogic terms. But you're all probably familiar with Gandhi, and Gandhi was famously a karma yogi. So karma yogi yoga is another very respected and powerful path. It's a path of action, path of direct action to transform one's own innate tendencies of selfish desire, selfish regard, and transform those into something that is more aligned with the collective well-being, collective compassion, and even the earth. So I'm just trying to say there's different paths. And I'll be very, just like I was pretty disparaging of the Garland practices for many years, I also was a self-defined anti-bhakti person. Bhakti yoga gave me allergies. My skin would break out in hives. I remember one time going to a kirtan, which is when it's a devotional form of chanting in group. I went to the Berkeley Performance Center to hear Krishna Das perform once, and within three bars of the music and concert starting, the guy next to me threw his hands in the air and started shaking uncontrollably and was in a rhapsodic state that terrified me. And I had wanted to be nothing around that kind of scary, I thought, a sort of abdication of rationality and reason. It scared me, and I literally just got up and left the concert immediately. So I have a strong history of bhakti allergy. But as these things go, the thing you avoid the most might actually be the most corrective and balancing and healing thing that you need. And I think that's proves to be the case for me, that I know I'm not alone here. I remember having conversations with Jack Engler about this, that he would always say that he found that people who had done insight practice for 30 years, he'd known them for that long, but people who have been practicing westernized insight practice of Buddhism for 30 years found that after 30 years, their practice was feeling very dry, very sterile in a way, very dry of heart energy, a lack of heart pumping, that many of these dried out Vipassana practitioners, these desiccated hearts of Vipassana, would show up at bhakti concerts, at kirtan concerts, trying to cross-pollinate or draw from some other tradition to bring some juice, to bring some real vitality and spirit back into their spiritual life. And that's a great thing to do. You know, chanting and singing and dancing, I think, wonderful additions to any practice. But for me, I have found the rosary, I found beaded practices, whether it's I'm using my Buddhist familiar mantras, or we're just working with traditional articulation of the rosary in English that I've come in contact with. I have found personally that inviting, and this is really what it's about, we're inviting in a personal relationship within the unique situations and conditions of your own life, but inviting a unique relationship with your own personal expression of the divine. And I'm suggesting, given my own professional patriarchal tendencies, that it might be helpful and corrective, supportive to explore what that means and to emphasize the feminine, to emphasize the goddess. And I know this is similar to in recovery groups within AA, that there's an encouragement to invoke a higher power that is one that you sort of it's a personalized sense of the higher power that is meaningful to you and is valuable to you. So I know I've been talking a few minutes over my time. So I guess if I were to give you a bit of an assignment this week, in light of what I've been doing, which is to read back through the history of, to try to read up on the history of mantras and traditions that I'm interested in, I encourage you maybe to explore something similar. You know, take a mantra or take a form of a practice and just do some research about the history of it. And in shopping around in a way, looking through different traditions, explore what it means to take one like a song. Take one mantra like a song and work with it so that you commit the words to heart, the sounds of the syllables to heart to begin with. But then spend some time with it long enough to feel into the heart of the spine of it. And what I found is I don't necessarily have to alter that, the root mantra that I'm drawing from. So whether it's Om Mani Padme Hum or the Hail Mary, I don't have to alter the language of that. But in working with that traditional mantra and really feeling into, okay, what's going on in my life? What do I want to ask for? What do I want to grow? What do I want to bring into my life? What do I want to give birth to in my life? From that alignment with the creative energy, then I might have a personal mantra or a personal request or a personal question that I want to live. So I try to pair the received tool of a phrase, the received tool of a spiritual spine, and pair that with a recomposed articulation of my own unique need. Just like a pose, what's your unique need for doing a pose? And you compose your body in alignment with that unique need. And I'm trying to suggest the same approach can be applied to working with beads. Okay, I hope you enjoyed some of those reflections, and I hope they inspire some exploration and creativity and trialing things in your practice, just exploring new avenues in your practice. I feel like I continue to learn more and more about the impact of bead-based practices and working with the rosary itself, and also weaving in Buddhist contemplative practices into the rosary and mixing it and not being afraid to hybridize, but to make the practice my own. And that's been very enriching for me. And I hope some of those thoughts about it all will stimulate and be enriching for you. Again, do consider availing yourself of our free 2-week membership to the Riverbird Sangha, it's where lives begin to flow. That's the riverside. So we learn how to flow with our life more naturally. And the bird side is, it's the Sangha where hearts take flight. So as our lives begin to flow, our hearts, the bird of our experience, the spirit energy of our life can take flight and become fully realized. That's the aim here, and we're doing it all together. And it's really an honor to practice with the group we have, and we invite you to join us or join along with us. I also know there's a lot of really unsettling news, whether it's domestically in the United States, domestically in Europe, whether it's the wars, the escalation of the Middle East, Ukraine. It's all looking not so good. And I don't have sage-like answers for any of it, but it's very upsetting. And to everyone that is affected by this, these forms of violence, these forms of tribalism, my heart goes out to you, and I wish you all the best in your practice, and may we all practice well to resist the totalizing effects and ongoing karma of empire. That's one way I'll just summarize it right there. But thanks for listening. Stay strong, keep practicing, and we will see you soon. Thanks so much.